Remember time? A year or so ago, I was in a banquet room in Snowbird, Utah, outside of Salt Lake City, and we recorded a lively conversation about 2019. That conversation ended up having to be re-recorded, but that's besides the point. Imagine being able to tell those people that a global pandemic would change everything that they know about daily life and how they do their jobs. Imagine telling those folks that their unique part of government would take new prominence and take a very forward-facing role. Imagine telling them that they had to do all of that while still trying to move the needle on everything else going on in their field. Well, imagine no more. While we can't talk to our past selves, we can definitely recap what the year has brought us. This is GIS Address. Welcome to the third season finale of GIS Addressed here on the Scoop News Group podcast network. On this show, we work together with the folks at the National States Geographic Information Council to tell the stories of GIS in government and how the technologies impact both government employees and citizens. I'm your host, Jake Williams, State Scoop's associate publisher. On today's episode, we're looking back again at the year that was 2020. It exhausts me just to say the name, but here we are. Joining me to talk about the year, I have NISGIC's president and New York State GIO, Frank Winters. Frank, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you, Jake, and thanks for your interest and StateScoop's interest in GIS and NISGIC. Happy to be here.
And I'm also joined by NISGIC's immediate past president and enterprise GIS and data visualization coordinator for the state of Wyoming, Karen Rogers. Karen, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Jake. It's good to be back.
And finally, we have Jenna Levier, a deputy state cartographer for our Arizona State Land Department. Jenna, welcome to GIS Addressed.
Thanks, Jake. It's great to be here.
So everyone, let's dive in here. 2020 was obviously pretty dominated by coronavirus response, something we've talked about quite a bit on the episodes we've done of GIS Addressed so far this year. But let's zoom out a bit and talk about how COVID-19 has changed the role of the GIO and the day-to-day work of GIS leaders. So Frank, we'll start with you. How did COVID-19 change the role of the GIO and what your day-to-day work life was like?
Yeah, that's really an interesting question. And certainly all these have some challenges and some silver linings, but it's pretty clear that GIS has been front page news for almost a year now, and that alone has had an impact. And really across the country, there are people doing fantastic work, but there's this underlying sense that the whole community, the geospatial community, can make an even more impactful role. So that really started NISGIC and many of us into some new relationships and new collaborations. NAPSIG is the National Association of National Alliance of Public Safety GIS, and ERISA, the Urban and Regional Information Systems Association. We all came together and said, "Hey, let's pull together some." We called it after action, but really it's during action. Reports and surveys and really take the pulse of the community and find out what's working and what isn't. And that alone, that exercise has really galvanized the relationships between some organizations that were working, you know, fairly independently in the past. And that's been a wonderful and insightful study. And that will result in a playbook to really advance the space of geospatial in pandemics, but at the same time, really advance a lot of the core things that we've been trying to get done for a long time. And just to take a little example into what you might expect to see out of that, I'll drive you all the way back to 1854 in London, and there was a cholera outbreak. And conventional thinking on the spread of cholera was that it was spread much like we know COVID to be spread. But Dr. John Snow, who was really an unexpected contributor to solving that problem, he was a surgeon and not even an internal medicine doctor. He had a different idea, and he didn't use test tubes and microscopes to find a cure for cholera. He used a map. He mapped all the cholera cases and found that most of them were closer to a particular water well. So that really is a good example for us. He really changed epidemiology as a spatial science in 1854. So now we look around the country and we ask ourselves, are we making data available to unusual or unexpected participants who can help solve the problem? And are we doing that at a spatial resolution that would allow Dr. John Snow to have found that well? And the answer is varied across the country. That's going to be some of what you can look forward to in the playbook that that we'll be putting out. Wisconsin is a shining example. They put out COVID test data aggregated to census tract. So at a high enough resolution to really understand the local variations in the spread and impact of the disease, but yet aggregated to a level that still protects personal privacy. Well, and talk about an unexpected contribution. MIT picked up that data and did a wonderful study that really got to the heart of what some of those differences in the spread from area to area really are. So that was just a nice example of spatial resolution. Our ability to resolve smaller and smaller differences is really what we're talking about, because the impacts of and the spread of COVID has been fairly localized and very different neighborhood to neighborhood. Then when it comes to temporal resolution, it's really our ability to resolve smaller and smaller slices of time and kind of remove some of the latency. There's been some really nice work done in testing wastewater. And picture one test that can pick up the COVID count of a whole affected population, which really is the sewer shed. So we kind of combine really interesting biology work with the spatial science to say, okay, this sample represents this group of people because these are the parcels that in their assessment data are tagged as having a sewer connection. And so we know what the contribution of the geography is to that particular sewage treatment plant. So both the spatial and temporal resolution, those are the kind of things that we'll be spelling out moving forward.
You know, Frank, I would have never expected you to take us back to 1854. So thank you for that. That's definitely an interesting perspective, and crazy the similarities that we find here in 2020 with times past. Jenna, I want to go to you. Tell me a little bit about how COVID-19 has changed the role of the GIO from your perspective and the day-to-day work of GIS leaders like you.
Well, in so many ways, it's hard to capture one, right? Definitely, I'm a silver linings kind of person. I seem to look at most challenges as opportunities. So I guess I have two things to share. I would say that COVID has given geospatial leaders an opportunity to work with unusual suspects or people, industries that we had maybe not totally thought about collaborating with in the past, and now we see more clearly where that can be opportunistic for all of us. So an example of that is our collaborative relationships with the health departments at the state level, at the county level. So, you know, prior to COVID, it was pretty ancillary. On my board, on Arizona's board, we have a geospecialist that sits on our board from health, but there isn't a huge influence and a huge discussion on how we can best support their industry as a whole, as a state, and how we can collaborate together. Well, now that conversation is happening, and we're talking about how we can work better together and how we can best support each other. So that's a good example of a new turn that we've taken because of the opportunity. Other opportunities are, you know, where is the Wi-Fi? Where are our connections? Because all of our kids are working remotely, and do we have the bandwidth? So it really brings up opportunities to work with different partners in the state. Our broadband office here in Arizona, we have started a conversation that we hadn't started before that we really needed to. So I think it's a great opportunity. I think to kind of go back to what Frank was saying as like proof and point for Arizona, some leaders in Southern Arizona looked at the sewer shed and the latency of COVID, and they were able to identify clearly that there was an outbreak of COVID at the university that they hadn't identified before. So they were able to quarantine that population very quickly and have a quick response because they partnered with GIS. and looked at that as an opportunity, right? So I think it's a really exciting time, and I'm not sure we really know all of the possibilities yet, but we're working through that.
With all the changes that COVID-19 brought, what were some of the necessary changes to the technical infrastructure of how these geospatial projects played out, and how did you get those done? Jenna, you first.
I think the biggest thing was that we all work remotely, right? We all of a sudden overnight were sent home, and you still need to perform your job. So I can't speak for everyone, but I can speak for Arizona and how things went here. I don't feel like we really had that on our radar. And how do you support, you know, vast numbers of people remotely? You know, the beauty of GIS in many cases is that there is an opportunity for cloud-based applications, right? Much of our industry is cloud-based. So if a person has an internet connection, they're set and they can do their job. They're good. It's very simple. That's not the case for everyone because resources are distributed differently, but it definitely is a motivating force for some places to move to the cloud-based opportunity, right? I think our industry has really been able to bounce very quickly and repivot to a very productive place, even given the remote environment. So I think it's exciting.
And Frank, what about you from your perspective? I mean, what were some of the necessary changes to the technical infrastructure of these geospatial projects, and how'd you get those done?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And really kind of speaking across some of the things we found across the country is that many states, those that have a 24/7 awareness and responsibility and have really been engaged with emergency management, we're sort of already used to working remotely. So we were pretty fortunate, as many of our colleagues around the country, that to move to remote work was sort of like the things we're called to do on a Saturday anyway, often. So it was fairly painless. Now, much of the technology that was stretched is really the responsibility of our IT organizations around the country, even the expansion of the broadband service was pretty remarkable. But sort of in that case, we're relying on and others to pull a lot of that off.
Karen, I want to bring you in here. Tell me about your take on sort of the technical infrastructure needed for these geospatial projects, maybe from your perspective in Wyoming.
Yes, thank you. So we are not as far along as other states, I think, with getting a modernized IT infrastructure. And so the benefit that I saw in many of our agencies was it finally pushed them to adopt a cloud infrastructure and cloud environment for, in particular, their GIS workflows. And so that's a huge positive and really enabled our workforce to be able to successfully do their jobs at home. So it was just a big breakthrough for our state to take that step to the cloud.
Frank said it in his answer to the first question, but with the GIS landscape in state governments so rapidly gaining prominence due to events like COVID-19, how does that change or increase the importance of existing projects like the National Address Database, NextGen 911, and geo-enabled elections? Karen, you first.
Thanks. To me, it all goes back to address data. You know, all three of the examples you listed, you know, the NAD was one of them, the National Address Database, which is one of our biggest advocacy efforts, but having national level addresses drives NextGen 911 and it drives geo-enabled elections. And I think we saw that the importance of that when you look at voting by mail. That whole process is driven by correct address data. And the better address data you have, the more efficiently that process is going to go. And, you know, I don't have any statistics off the top of my head, but I'm sure that 911 dispatching was up, of course, in our COVID times. And so again, just driving home the need for good address data. And, you know, if you're suffering from COVID and you can't breathe to the extent that you can't speak, then being able to have that public safety answering point pick up your location from your smartphone could potentially save your life. Whereas if you had to speak, you might not be able to tell them your location. So, the technology is just critical to making all these things work. And it just all goes back to addresses, which is just one of eight framework data that, we as GIOs work to improve and make available for the variety of uses.
And Frank, what about your perspective here? I mean, how does these prominent events like COVID-19 really change or alter the importance of existing projects like the NAD and the NextGen 911 and geo-enabled elections?
Yeah, that's great, and I couldn't agree more with Karen. It really changes by strengthening our resolve, and our address data is critical. I had these thoughts that, contributing to a national database it's kind of altruistic, right? We've got everything we need to solve our own little problems in our own geographic area. And it's the right thing to do to contribute nationwide so others can take advantage of that. But now I've really started to understand that many of the challenges and many of the things we're trying to pull off are more efficient and more effective if we do them nationwide. Why would a 911 software vendor need to do something different for every state just because our addresses are all different? If we contribute it to the National Address Database and it's up there in the standard that the National Emergency Numbering Association has put together, then we're in good shape, and we don't need to pay for one-offs across the country for everyone's little different flavor, right? So we've contributed that. And then you think about things like COVID test data location. And some of the test data may have a PO box in it because that's what somebody used for their address. And the question I ask is, all right, let's make the correlation. If you were having chest pains right now and you dialed 911, would you give them your PO box? Probably not. That's not going to really help you. So let's use that address. And by the way, there's no need for us to mail you anything when you take your COVID test. We just need to know where you are and be able to use that in good science. So it's really the combination, so people understand, oh yeah, okay, when I'm talking about my location, I'm talking about the location I use when I call 911, but it's useful for so many other things, and it's different use case than getting a piece of mail to me. Even making something like the address data available nationwide, it's much easier to get that into the hands of the commercial providers who are really having a great impact on our mobility, the wayfinding and GPS companies, which we can talk about more later. But if we're able to find addresses more efficiently because we've contributed to a national collection, then all that activity that happens in our jurisdiction is just happening more effectively. People are getting their packages faster. People are getting their pizza faster. And by the way, they're also going to get a better chance of having that address right when it comes to that your worst day when you have to call 911. So it does just strengthen our resolve, I think, and I couldn't agree more with what Karen said.
Yeah, and what about you, Jenna? I want to hear your perspective on this. I mean, we talk about these world events really helping GIS gain prominence. How does that change or increase the importance of some of the existing projects that we've been talking about?
Thanks, Jake. I have to say the same thing that Frank said. I couldn't agree more with both Frank and Karen on this. I think one of the things that is important to recognize, and I know we're talking an awful lot about addresses, but it does go to other data sets as well, is cross-boundary collaboration is really important. That's where a national framework comes in and is incredibly valuable. We need to be able to work together across jurisdictions. COVID doesn't know boundaries. It doesn't at all. Our ability to work remotely isn't necessarily boundary related. So that comes back to addresses and broadband and having connectivity, right? So I just think it really brings to our attention where these national conversations are needed and where the national collaboration is really vital to keeping everything moving efficiently and serving our people, which is really what we want to do, right? We want to serve each other and we want to make our communities better. So I think a piece of that that's very, very important is our foundation.
So looking ahead, I mean, there's so much talk about emerging technology and how it's going to impact CIOs, but I'm really curious about how it will play a role in GIOs' lives as well. I mean, tell me a little bit more about how you see emerging technology beginning to shift your work going forward. Karen, let's go to you.
Thanks, Jake. This is the topic that keeps me up at night, and I just cannot spend enough time, you know, pondering. And one of the most exciting fields, in my opinion, excuse me, is blockchain. And I've been thinking that the best way to intersect blockchain technology with GIS goes to parcel mapping and land ownership data. And so I'm really excited to see how that is evolving. And the other exciting field to me is autonomous vehicles. And I see that as, of course, changing our transportation landscape. And that could also intersect with blockchain. But again, those two very exciting areas are built on framework data. So while it's kind of having a foot in two worlds where, you know, on the one hand, we're really trying to push the envelope and embrace these new technologies, we have to remember that they're built on our foundational data that, again, states need to really focus on building, improving, maintaining, and making accessible openly to the public. So to me, those are the two areas that I just really like to think about how we as GIS professionals can affect that future landscape.
I mean, when we talk about things like emerging technology, what about you, Frank? What are you thinking about? What are you staying up at night thinking about like Karen?
Well, it's interesting because through NISGIC, we're able to not just keep track of some emerging technology, but we're able to influence it. And change is a lot less scary when you are calling for it and you have some role in driving that bus, you know? So, but talking about the role, there's a question that we keep having to ask. And asking the question is more important than actually coming to the answer. And that question throughout our careers has been, what's the role of government in this space? You know, we started our careers and most of the mapping that was happening was being called for or being done by government, right? And now cell phone companies for a decade now have been duking it out over the quality of their maps. Well, that's just going to continue. So what's the role of government and how do we harness that but play the appropriate role? And to tag on to something that Karen just said, we have what sets the stage for autonomous vehicles is going to be a disruptive but wonderful advancement. The framework data necessary for that is also some of the framework data that's necessary to get in the hands of GPS and wayfinding companies right now. And if you think about it, smartphone wayfinding and in-vehicle wayfinding has changed the traffic safety landscape of the country. In some cases, for the better. I believe I'm a better driver when I drive in a city I'm not familiar with, and I know the exit is on the left up ahead, and I can see that on the map, and I prepare myself. But certainly in some cases, inappropriate, and people are blindly following some directions that really get them in trouble. So by making those steps and kind of eating on the way to the dream, right? So we have this dream of being able to have efficient and really safe autonomous vehicles. Well, we can improve the safety right now on the way. USDOT FHWA has a program where they're pulling together work zone data into a common format so that wayfinding companies can use that. But what about when that work zone clears and now there's a different exit number, and what you experience on your navigation device is not what you experience in the field, and you're looking for exit 6, but it says exit 60. Or a lamp or lane configuration or a bridge clearance. A vast majority of strikes to low bridges, when you take a deep look at it, it happened with people inappropriately following directions from a device that had no way to know that they were in a taller than a passenger car kind of vehicle. So all those things come together, and it's neat when we have a vision that drives it, but we have incremental improvements that really make safety improvements in this case along the way. So that's all kind of that strategy that we've taken for NISGIC, really in kind of strategic planning, that we're looking at foresight. We're taking that over the horizon look and seeing not just what technology is going to happen, but also having some role in influencing that change and helping to drive those things to positive outcomes. So we're looking at a long-term horizon for that when it comes to horizon to the technology. And then kind of, I like the term eating on the way to the dream.
And finally, Jenna, we'll take it to you. What are you thinking about when it comes to emerging technology and how it's going to impact the lives of GIOs?
Wow, I think that's a big question. I think that Karen and Frank have really done an excellent job of discussing aspects of that and kind of encapsulating some of our discussions at NISGIC and with our partners about what's to come. I think it's less important to know exactly what's to come, but be open and be able to explore what's on the horizon, like what Frank said. I know that, you know, one of the things that comes to mind for me is artificial intelligence and where that's going and how that's going to help us to solve some of our issues. Some of, you know, in Arizona, water is a big deal, and artificial intelligence can help us learn about how we use water inefficiently and allow us to make better choices. And that can happen entirely from a geospatial perspective. It all, you know, it all has a location, right? And so we can make better choices moving forward with better tools. And I think we're all excited to embrace those ideas. I think it's an exciting time for us to be able to look forward and try to anticipate and try to influence what that change is going to be for the best, right? We want our best next step.
Jenna, Frank, Karen, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation. And thanks for helping wrap up season 3 of GIS Addressed.
Our thanks to you, Jake, and again for your continued interest in the ever-exciting field of GIS.
Thank you, Jake.
Always a pleasure.
Well, that is that. Thanks again to Frank Winters, Karen Rogers, and Jenna Levier for being here as we cover the year that was. You're listening to the 3rd season of GIS Addressed here on StateScoop. We'll be back for season 4, bigger and better than ever, in 2021. Today's show was written and produced by me, Jake Williams, with help from our friends at the National States Geographic Information Council. Our show features music from Captive Portal, available via Creative Commons, for previous seasons of GIS Addressed, as well as all the latest news on how state and local governments are using technology. Head over to statescoop.com. I'm StateScoop Associate Publisher Jake Williams. Thanks for listening.